All financial advice provided on this show is for entertainment and educational purposes only. The financial ideas and strategies discussed are only provided as a starting point for a conversation about money matters. With regard to your particular investments and financial strategies, consult your financial planner, CPA, or investment professional. All your financial decisions are yours and yours alone to make and subsequently are solely your responsibility. The information that is supplied through the context of the radio program and any repurposing of its content by the host or network is a combination and collection of solid financial investment understanding, opinion, and comments. This network, show, and its host are not liable for financial strategies, outcomes that you employ in any manner that result in any kind of loss. Shares of corporate sponsors may be the subject of buy or sell recommendations in Jay Taylor's newsletter in accordance with Jay's objective opinion.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. This hour will help investors fix issues and achieve personal gain. Now, here's your host, Jay Taylor.
Welcome to Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I am your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm speaking to you from the borough of Queens, as I usually do, here in New York City, and it is the 15th day of November, 2022. I do want to remind you that I publish a newsletter called Jay Taylor's Gold, Energy, and Tech Stocks. It's focused primarily on junior mining stocks, junior exploration companies, companies that actually find and then develop real wealth, real money, if you will, gold and silver in the ground. And so I think a very exciting time for that sector right now, and you'll hear a little bit more about that in the second segment of today's show. I do want to mention Chen Lin. What is Chen buying? What is Chen selling? You can sign up for his letter as well. What is Chen buying? What is Chen selling? Is the name of his letter. ChenPicks.com is the place to go to sign up for Chen's letter. Also, like to encourage you to send along whatever comments you have about this show to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. Questions4taylor@gmail.com. And our sponsors for today's show, those that make this show economically viable, Irving Resources, Noble Resources, Gold Bull Resources, El Oro Resources, Reyna Gold Mining, and Timberline Resources. I've titled today's show, The Mechanics of Fiat Money Destruction. Alistair MacLeod and Quentin Henning are my guests today. Human beings have been capable of believing, ever since Eve ate the forbidden fruit in the Garden of Eden, that they could be like God simply by obeying without limit their hedonistic desires. The big lie, most relevant to the topic of this week's show, is the one told by Lord Maynard Keynes in 1935 when he suggested that societies should become rich, or actually could become rich, by consuming more than they produce. To lend credence to that lie, Keynes required honest, market-driven money, gold, be replaced by fiat money, that is, money manufactured from debt. Fiat money has no intrinsic value. It is a faith-based money. And as we have just seen with the FTX cryptocurrency debacle that is now playing out in the crypto and financial markets, when the debt upon which money is manufactured can't be repaid, that money quickly becomes worthless. Also, what Keynes didn't reveal and politicians chose not to know was that at some point in time, as debt outgrows the income of a national or international on an international scale or on a national scale, the more fiscal and monetary stimulus that are created, the less positive effect they have on the growth. And then at some point in time, like now, for example, monetary and fiscal stimulus actually turns negative. So, for example, the fiscal stimulus that the Biden administration forced into the economy after Joe Biden became president was a major factor in the surge of inflation that is now more than offsetting the nominal wage gains of workers. Among institutions, the most vulnerable of all during either an inflation or a deflationary outcome are banks that have loaded up their balance sheets with enormous amounts of debt relative to their equity holdings. In the second half of today's show, I will ask Alistair MacLeod to help us understand the market dynamics that banks are now facing that guarantee their inability to continue making loans if they desire to keep their banks solvent. How then does he expect governments to respond to an economy, to an economic downturn that results from a lack of lending by banks acting in their own interest, not being able to make loans. Well, economies, especially economies like this one, that is based on credit and debt-based money, cannot survive. So how will the federal bank, how will the federal government and other governments around the world react to this impending economic debacle? Looking at long periods of history, when major economic calamities take place, such as during the Great Depression and during the inflationary 1970s, major systemic changes in monetary systems are usually implemented. There are a growing number of analysts who think we are on the precipice now of a major monetary system reset. This is one of the most, if not the most, uncertain times that I can recall, uncertain in many different ways, geopolitically, monetarily, just a lot of unrest and division in our country, more than 70 in all of the 75 years of life that I've lived so far. I can't remember a time that's been more tumultuous than this. The 60s certainly were a time when there was a great deal of difficulty in our society, but I can't recall a country that was so divided as it is now, nor can I even in those days and in the 70s remember an economy that was in such perilous straits as this current one is. And so through all of this, all of these uncertainties that we are experiencing, one thing that has been as stable as anything, and that is gold. The purchasing power of gold has not changed over thousands of years. What we can say with regard to the current situation is that despite the decline in stocks and bonds this year, gold has held up reasonably well. Just before we went to the show, before we went on this show live today, I checked, and gold was down by just 2.89% so far this year. Now that compares with an S&P that has lost 16.5%. And long-dated treasuries, my goodness, they're down 30% or so. So despite very few people having any desire to own gold these days, relatively few, at least in America, gold is performing its function of preserving wealth relatively well. And so it makes sense to look for companies that produce real money, that is gold, which retains its intrinsic value for the long term and thus avoids these cataclysmic declines in wealth. When we come back from the break, world-renowned exploration geologist Dr. Quentin Henning will join me to introduce, well, I think five or six different exploration projects that he's really excited about. Those are in the gold and silver fields, primarily gold and silver exploration projects that he's working on or he is investing in through Crescat Capital or with Crescat Capital. So Quentin will be with us to talk about some of those. One of them are actually a sponsor to this show, but the others are not. And they're stories that I think if you're interested in investing in the exploration sector, you won't want to miss what Dr. Quentin Henning has to say. So we are going to go to break now, but don't go away. We'll be right back with Dr. Quentin Henning.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
The latest business information is made simple with the Voice America Business Network. The professionals in the business world bring you live talk radio shows featuring an array of business topics, strategies for building wealth, sales and marketing, stock trading, investing, and business technology. Voice America business hosts are professionals in their fields and bring to the airwaves weekly business discussions that offer up-to-date information, advice, and education. The Voice America Business Network. The bottom line in business talk.
We hear it and read about it every day in the news.
America is heading over a fiscal cliff. Home prices are still receding and unemployment growing.
How can you preserve and increase your wealth in this kind of economy? Tune in to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with host Jay Taylor. Jay will explain the decline of our monetary system and the economy and will give you winning investment ideas and the tools to protect and increase your wealth. Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor can be heard Tuesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, 12 noon Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, Turning Hard Times to Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor, and I'm glad to tell you that Dr. Quentin Henning is with me again to share some of his top picks with you today. And some of you who are older, like me, can remember an advertisement for a brokerage firm named E.F. Hutton. Remember, those of you who can remember, there was an ad on television that proclaimed that when E.F. Hutton speaks, people listen, at which time all of the people walking around on the street stopped and cupped their ears so that they could hear what E.F. Hutton was saying. And so that's kind of the way I think when I listen to Quentin Henning. It's, I want to hear what Quentin Henning has to say about exploration companies. He has a great reputation, has found been responsible in the discovery of some world-class deposits over the years, having worked for major companies and then more recently for juniors, and now working with Crescat Capital, which is a company that is doing very much invested, one of the few that are invested in the exploration sector. They seem to see the potential that most other investment firms are not recognized, or at least not to the degree that Crescat is. And within the last couple of years, Quentin joined that firm formally, and so he's involved every week on Fridays at about 2 o'clock Eastern time, and sometimes a few minutes later, to tell people about the companies that that Crescat is investing in and the reasons for it. And Quentin speaks to that. So it's really great to have him today with us to share a couple of the stories, a few of the stories that he's most excited about. Thank you, Quentin, so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you, Jay.
It's really always good to hear from you. You are a frequent guest on this show, sometimes talking about our sponsors. Today, most of them are not sponsors, but there's very exciting stories. I guess maybe before I ask you to talk about the first one, Eloro Resources, maybe just tell our listeners what it is, talk in lay terms, what it is that you look for before you suggest to Crescat that they commit some capital to exploration projects.
That's a really good question, and I'm kind of glad you started there, because this opportunity I've had to work with Crescat has really given me a chance to, you know, focus on allocating capital in the exploration space. And, you know, what we like to focus on are potential discoveries of, you know, of world-class magnitude, you know, like tier one status. Okay. We're looking for big discoveries. And even if they're very early stage, you know, if the story is compelling, if there's enough evidence, the surficial evidence, footprint of the alteration system, the geochemical expression of the system, looking at analogs in the area, you know, what might a new discovery look like? Those kind of data we bring back, and I kind of pick them apart. I talk with the company usually at length about what their exploration strategy is, because we like to make sure if we invest money that it's allocated towards exploration. For the most part, we've had very good experience with companies. We have meaningful discussions about how they're going to use the capital that they get from these raises and allocate it to make discovery. And, you know, and in some cases, I'm fortunate to even get to help, you know, on the technical side with this, which I like to do. So it's really a combination of factors. It's really about looking at the opportunity, you know, the geological, geochemical, and geophysical aspects of the opportunity, and looking at, of course, jurisdiction is very important. You know, we got to have a jurisdiction where there's demonstrable ability to build mines. I don't want to invest in countries where there's no history of building mines, or there's opposition, you know, social or otherwise, to it. We want to invest in places where we know there can be mines built. And, you know, at the end of the day, and then the last component, of course, is, you know, working with the management and exploration team that's going to focus on the prize. They got to explore. And the goal is to find discoveries that are going to be purchased by major mining companies. You know, this is really the product of most junior companies out there, is to make discovery that's going to ultimately be sold.
Yeah, yeah. Most juniors are not successful, or it's very, very few and far between that, where the exploration is one skill set, and then production and you know, building, engineering, and building and producing is another skill set. And so, best to do what you know you're best at, and just stick to your knitting, as they say. Well, let's start out by one of the companies that you like a lot, and it is a sponsor to this show, Elorrf Resources. ELORRF in the U.S., 69.9 million shares. I sold it earlier today, $2.22 in U.S. money, $154 million market cap. It's a company with a silver tin-rich polymetallic deposit, and it's a big one in Bolivia. I believe they're going to come out with a resource pretty soon, or just give us a story on this one again.
Sure. Look, very early stage, we invested in this. It was back in 2020, kind of the couple months into the pandemic, in fact. And, you know, the reason I jumped in, or wanted Crescat to jump in, is because the exploration team certainly knows what they're doing. Osvaldo Arce and Bill Pearson, very top-notch team. But the evidence they showed me was compelling that this was a mega world-class silver polymetallic system like one would find elsewhere in Bolivia. And there's several examples, okay, in Bolivia. I would say the Potosí district, which is a historic mining district that is still actually in active production, artisanal miners miner, is huge. It's produced, you know, about 1.5 to 2 billion ounces of silver at best estimate. But then you have other mines like San Cristobal, which is in Bolivia, which is producing mine. It's a silver zinc lead mine that's been operating for about 15 years and absolutely produced huge amounts of those metals. Okay, and this Isca property, when they first showed it to me, it was clear the footprint, the geology, this collapsed caldera setting, everything about it smelled like a major new discovery. They started drilling in September of 2020. They haven't stopped drilling. In fact, they've been drilling many holes. I think they're getting upwards of around 100,000 meters. And at this point, they've demonstrated there's a volume of rock that's on the order of 2 cubic kilometers that is mineralized. Okay, it's not all mineralized, but, you know, within that 2 cubic kilometers, there's a substantial amount, probably, you know, on the order of 30, 40, 50% of the area at any given location is mineralized. So, you know, we're looking at a deposit that could be hundreds of millions of tons. What's it likely going to deliver? Well, I think it'll deliver a very typical resource for this type of system. It'll probably have, you know, around 30, 40 grams silver on average. You know, it kind of comes and goes. There's areas where it's higher and lower, you know, but you got to take it as a whole, about 30, 40 grams silver. But then the lead zinc is probably going to be combined about maybe 1.5% or 2%. And then it's got this tin component. This tin component is a real value add, because tin, very high price, about $20,000 a ton, plus or minus right now. And it's got about maybe 0.1 to 0.2% tin at any given location. So this thing is truly a, you know, kind of a cornucopia of different metals all compacted into one. They've done enough metallurgy to show that it produces very high quality concentrates that are going to be saleable anywhere on the planet. And it's really, you know, in March, I believe, is when they're targeting their initial resource estimate. And I think it'll set the table for, you know, the market will clearly see that this is a world-class discovery, but also set the table for, you know, what could be a compelling story to that will be advanced towards production over the next couple of years. Bolivia is, in my view, a very, very good location. They've made great strides to improve the political and you know, investment climate in the country. They're basically where Peru was in the early 1990s. They're really shifting to a much more friendly environment. So I think that I think this is a great discovery in a jurisdiction that is turning around very quickly.
Well, you think so? In March of next year, we a maiden resource. That's the target date, anyway. Might we expect something, you know, hundreds of millions of ounces of silver potentially? I mean, you're talking 30 grams or something like that over a huge amount of rocks.
Exactly. Look, my guess is, you know, on the order of 400 million on the low end, million tons, maybe on the high end, even get closer to a billion. I don't know. I mean, it depends on the resource modelers.
Sure.
But yes, I mean, if you're talking those kind of grades, you know, you're talking about hundreds of millions of ounces of silver, but also many, many millions of tons of zinc and lead mineralization or metal, you know, metal mm-hmm. in the ground, as well as tin, like an enormous amount of tin. Okay, so this thing's going to have a very, very good ending.
All right. A second one that I know you're in love with, well, I shouldn't say that because I don't know, maybe things have changed, but Snowline Gold Corp, and I can't imagine that you're not in love with it after we saw the assays that were announced, I guess, just this morning. It was just phenomenal.
Absolutely.
Just to tell us about Snowline.
Yeah, look, it's an amazing discovery. It's in the Yukon. It's what we call a Tintina type or Tombstone type gold system. It's associated with what we call reduced intrusions. In this case, the reduced intrusion is a diorite or granodiorite body that brought up just a huge amount of gold, and it produces a fairly disseminated style of gold mineralization. It's got a little bit of bismuth and tellurium, but these things are typically very metallurgically friendly, and that's what makes them work. You know, these things run a gram or two per ton. In this case, the high grade core is probably looking on the order of 250-300 million tons is my best guess, maybe upwards of 2 grams per ton, something like that. So that's a huge, huge discovery in itself with a halo around it that's starting to take shape. I do think the system is going to take some more drilling next year. What I'm seeing is as we see data come in, the picture becomes more and more clarified. It looks like the high-grade core, which is now well established, is a very, very large size, but it also appears to extend to depth. It looks like it has some deep, deep roots to it. So that's going to have to be tested next year. But it also looks like the west and southwest side of the intrusion, the mothership, we'll call it, is also mineralized out into the Hornfels, into the country rock. So, you know, this thing has really taken shape. You know, I've said publicly several times, you know, on the low end, I mean, look, this is almost certainly a 20 million ounce discovery. Could it be much more? Yeah, I think so, especially when coupled with some of the nearby targets they have, like the Gracie target, which is just across the hill. Okay, these are enormous systems, and this one is well endowed with grade. You know, typical Tintina type might run a gram. This one is running more like 2 grams. Okay, that's a big, big plus. People say, oh, it's remote. Well, you know what? It's not so bad. There's actually a winter road not too far from there. I've met with the ministry, you know, the various politicians and civil servants that work in the Yukon to discuss this location, the ability to build a mine here. I've also looked into the First Nations. This is a First Nation territory that is where Eagle is built. Okay, so we're dealing with the same, First Nations in every respect too. So, you know, I mean, this thing is an amazing discovery that will become probably the biggest, in my view, the biggest single gold deposit discovered in Canada since Hemlock.
Wow, that's saying something. Well, I want to thank you very much for this. Certainly, I learned to know of this story through you, and also my subscribers are very pleased as well. We've done very well with it, having purchased it early on. Well, you know, a fraction of what it's selling at now, $2, around $2 in U.S. money today, 132 million shares. Okay, well, then, which leads me to another story, and you sort of teased your listeners, your viewers at Crescat Gets Active, the video that you guys do every Friday, about the next Snowline target. And I've sort of learned to know that maybe that might be tectonic metals. Maybe you just comment on that real quickly.
Certainly. Look, Tectonic has a project they call the Flat Project. It's in Western Alaska, which is at almost the opposite polar extremity of the Tintina Belt from Snowline's project. But, they have what is absolute hands down a very, very large Tintina type system. Footprint of the alteration in the gold system is on the order of about 6 to 8 square kilometers. It's absolutely huge. It's actually not far from Donnelly Creek. So, you know, there's an analog nearby, although this one is not refractory. Okay. I've one of the tests I had, you know, to make sure we wanted to invest was to look at the metallurgy. And the metallurgy of this flat project is not refractory. So it is free milling, which is very important for these types of deposits. Now that the company kind of has the green light to go ahead and explore a flat, they had a few things they had to work out. They've got those worked out. We're jumping in both feet here. I think it's another major, major discovery in the making. There's about 50 or 60 historic holes on the property. actually, some of them drilled, or many of them drilled by Robert Friedland back in the 1990s.
Oh, uh-huh.
And, you know, you might say, well, why did Robert Friedland? Well, he found this little deposit in Mongolia called Oyutogoi, and then a lot, you know, drifted his attention drifted to Mongolia. But he left what is apparently amazing discovery in the making. So we're into that one. We've also, you know, people see, yes, in the past 24 hours, we've jumped into another story called Rackla. I won't go into details there, but it's in the Tintina Belt. In short, we're seeing the Tintina Belt as being one of the most prospective gold belts, you know, for exploration, prospective gold belts in the world, in the first, you know, first world, we'll call it, where you can build mines. So we're going all in on these discoveries.
Might you be talking about that new company, Crestcake, gets active this week? Possible.
We have our 100th anniversary. If we have time, I will, but we have another things lined up for this week. So it's a funny week.
Okay. Well, some time to come. Well, real quickly here, we're going to run out of time. Brixton Metals. Tell us about that one.
You know what? I'm going to talk about Brixton and Pacific Ridge. The reason I'm going to talk about both of them together is because earlier this year, you know, with copper at $4.50 a pound and talking with Kevin and Tavi, they wanted more exposure to copper. So we've jumped into both Pacific Ridge and Brixton at what I'll call cheap prices, early stage in some respects, discovery. But both of them now have demonstrable major copper and copper gold discoveries. Okay, so Brixton has Camp Creek, which is a buried porphyry, but it could be a billion tonner. It's running about 0.7%. BHP recognized the potential too, and they've jumped in both feet. They now have 20%. Of Brixton, so we're very happy co-investor alongside them. We also have 20%. Okay, we have Pacific Ridge, which now has two major copper gold discoveries of Clayul and RDP. Both look like they're lining up to be major discoveries of the ilk of Red Chris, you know, so they're very gold rich copper porphyries. They're associated with alkaline rocks. Both of them look like they're deep rooted. And they drilled a bunch of holes this year. They announced some from RDP that clearly show that thing could have absolutely shoot the lights out. By the way, that's in a joint venture with Antofagasta. And then they've got a lot of drill results coming back from Clayul here shortly. So I'd say, you know, hold on, wait for the news. I think we'll see good things out of both those companies. But it really gives us good exposure to exploration in the copper realm.
Copper and you've got gold, I think, with both projects, both companies, right?
Yes, correct.
They're gold, copper, gold, porphyries, and large, very large projects. And if a BHP comes into the picture, you know they have to believe there's something big there. They
exactly, yeah. Seeing these juniors like Brixton have BHP and then, you know, Antofagasta into Pacific Ridge, those are very, very, very good signs, okay?
All right. All right, with just a couple of minutes left, I know you mentioned before we came on the air, I-80 gold. I mean, my goodness. I mean, it's certainly one of my favorites. It's just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, this is a gold company that they've also come into some base metals. I guess we'll just talk about it.
I'm going to just hit this one hard. This is one of the best things that's happened in Nevada in decades, to be frank. And what they've done is they've taken an old district called Eureka. It's way down in south or central Nevada. And it's a district that a lot of people kind of have, you know, looked at, you know, as historic mining. Okay, there's a bit of base metal and a little bit of gold and silver. You know, some high grades, too. There was pretty good high grades in the camp. But it kind of saw, an end to mining in that era, like in the 1950s. You know, fast forward, gold was discovered there. Carlin-type gold was discovered in the 1990s by Homestake, which then became Barrick. The Ruby Hill mine and Archimedes were developed, and it made a great little gold mine, a little oxide gold mine at a very a tough time in the gold space. You know, gold was $2.50 an ounce in the 1990s, but it made money. Okay, so fast forward now, Ewan has picked up this ground, this basically consolidated a large block of ground there at the old Barrick property at Eureka. And he's drilling. And this is exactly what you need to do. In these old districts, drill. Okay, that's it. It's simple. You do good science, you drill, and they are making amazing discoveries. So not only are they finding more and more of the Carlin mineralization, which, you know, could be multi-million ounces as it's on its own, they're finding this absolutely amazing replacement, CRD-type mineralization, carbonate replacement mineralization, which is phenomenally great, you know, base metal, gold, silver, everything. I mean, it's just
astounding, the dollar value per ton of some of these drill intercepts they're seeing. These are some of the best intercepts I've seen in a long time, and I really wish the company well. I talked to Ewan yesterday. He's got big plans. He's going to extend his exploration as soon as he gets plans of operation set up for the southern area to extend this new discovery. He's recognized a porphyry target at depth. He said they might even drill that next year. He's recognizing that he's onto an absolutely immense system here. It could be a world-class deposit and have different styles of mineralization, Carlin, CRD, skarn. There could be porphyry down there. You know, it's kind of a cornucopia of different types of deposits in this case. So, good on him. Good on him.
Oh my, it's an amazing story. And of course, that's one of only about three or four projects that he's moving towards production, right? I mean, the others are good too.
Yes, that's correct. Yes, up at Turquoise, well, in the area around Granite Creek and stuff, absolutely great Carlin type deposits and potential. He's doing a great job.
Yeah, it's really a great story. Well, I want to thank you, Quentin, for spending a little time. These are just a few of the stories I know you're following that you're really involved with on behalf of Crescat Capital. And it's always great to hear from you, always great to get your input, because I know it means a lot. It brings confidence to people who know your track record. And it's actually the best of times to look at this sector because it's so unloved. And it's exactly at these times, I was just talking about, the uncertainty in the world these days, the uncertainty in our monetary system, the gold, the dollar-based system, is wearing thin and may be in trouble. Not at any better time than now, even though most people aren't interested, but that's the best time to look at things when nobody else wants them. And I thank you very much for helping us understand these stories. So that we can be prepared for when the times get better for this sector. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jay.
All right, folks, we do have to go to break, but Alistair McLeod is coming back with me right when we return. He'll have some insights into the banking sector, why the banks are having a tough time of this rising interest rate market and what that may mean for you, for your investments. So don't go away. We'll be right back with Alistair.
Follow us on Twitter at VoiceAmericaTRN. Get the lowdown on guests, new shows, and your favorites. That's VoiceAmericaTRN.
Timberline Resources is a mineral exploration and resource development company focused on gold discovery in the world-class mining jurisdiction of Nevada. The company's flagship Eureka project hosts a significant gold resource and drill-indicated upside potential at nearby higher-grade targets. Timberline Resources trades in Canada under the symbol TBR and on the OTCQB in the U.S. under the symbol TLRS. To learn more about this district-scale asset with exciting discovery potential, please visit www.timberlineresources.co.
Voice America programs are now available on your favorite connected device, including Amazon, Alexa, and Google Home. Through streams with Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, and iHeartRadio, listening to your favorite show is as easy as saying the show name followed by the word podcast.
Hey, Alexa. Play Finding Your Frequency podcast.
If that doesn't work, try adding on TuneIn or on iHeartRadio or on Apple Podcasts.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
You're listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with your host, Jay Taylor. If you have a question or comment about today's show, Jay would love to hear from you at 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also send an email to questionsfortaylor@gmail.com. That's questions, the number 4, taylor@gmail.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back to Turning Hard Times into Good Times. I'm your host, Jay Taylor. Really pleased to have one of our most frequent guests, Alistair McLeod, return. And I think I was just commenting to Alistair, I've seen more and more, I'm seeing Alistair appear on all manner of videos and television and so forth. And it's really great to see him because he is obviously a much sought after guest, and because he has a lot of great insights. And that's why people, I think people are looking to him more now than ever because of the uncertainties that are arising in our world, monetary and otherwise. So thank you so much, Alistair, for coming on with us again.
I'm honored to be on your program, Jay.
Well, it's really great, and I'm glad you're honored, because so are we. Goldmoney.com, the research page at goldmoney.com, folks, is where you should go every Thursday to read Alistair's weekly missives. Great insights into what's going on actually under the surface, not what you get from the propaganda and the mainstream media, that's for sure. And that's why he is of value to us. I've titled today's show, Alistair, The Mechanics of Fiat Money Destruction, because I think you explain why fiat money, given its absence, given the absence of gold and silver from it, it really has no intrinsic value. And it, given human nature, it seems to sort of, this self-destruction repeats itself over and over again. We don't want the constraints of gold or silver to tell us we can't just do what we want to do when we want to do it. And so honesty be damned, and let's go with the fun stuff. Your article, The Great Unwind, the second part of The Great Unwind, you had an earlier one that focused on the banking system and how they're getting in trouble, the banks. And well, that's what I'd like to explore with you and have you explain to our listeners, the mechanics of fiat money and the banks, and how rising interest rates are really causing a lot of trouble. You start out the article, this is your November 3rd article, by assuming inflation is rising out of control. And I'm reading some pundits like Lance Roberts or Jim Rickards, who think we're heading into a very serious economic downturn in 2023, and that with that downturn, rates will sharply decline. That's inflation and interest rates will sharply decline. Lance, for example, is even suggesting it might be time to start nibbling away at least at long-dated U.S. Treasuries. But it seems to me, in reading your most recent work, you're not buying that, or at least not in the longer term.
No, I'm not. The interesting situation that we have, Jay, is that banks are under pressure to contract their balance sheets. And that basically means that they need to call in their loans, not new loans, reduce the size of their balance sheets substantially. Now, while they do that on the asset side, obviously, it's going to have exactly the same effect on the deposit side, you know, mm-hmm. in other words, mm-hmm. the bank's liabilities. Mm-hmm. So we've got to sort of really understand what bank credit is in the context of the economy. Well, virtually all transactions in GDP are conducted or settled in bank credit. Mm-hmm. So obviously, if you get a contraction of bank credit, that impacts negatively on GDP. So that is what we're going to see. And I suspect that, you quoted Jim Rickards. I suspect that quite a number of people are seeing this and thinking that, well, this isn't inflation, this is deflation. This mm-hmm. is a contraction of the amount of credit in the economy. Mm-hmm. Now, that undoubtedly is true, but we've got to take into account the reaction of the central banks. When the Fed sees bank credit contracting, what it will do is it will pivot. It will stop any thoughts of quantitative tightening and instead go into quantitative easing mode. What it would hope to do also is to stop raising interest rates and begin to lower them in order to protect the economy. That's what they will do. So what we're going to see is a replacement of commercial bank credit with central bank credit. Mm-hmm. Now, the problem is, in terms of how this makes people look at the values of that credit, given that it's not anchored to money in any way at all, it is pure fiat, they will tolerate changes in the amount of commercial bank credit without, let's say, expecting, thinking they should change the relationship between the amount of liquidity they hold compared with the amount of spending that they indulge in on a day-to-day basis. In other words, they won't shift the general level of prices as much as they do when a central bank suddenly starts increasing the amount of central bank credit. That has a far greater psychological impact on individuals who use dollars, dollar credit currency for payments. So what you're going to see is not so, I mean, one of the big mistakes that everybody makes is they think that if the, you know, the price level is automatically tied to the quantity of credit in circulation. No, it is not. That credit is actually valued by its users. And if they start running scared, it doesn't matter what the quantity is or what's happening to the quantity, the purchase power of that circulating medium will diminish. And that's basically, in a nutshell, what I see happening. The other thing which I think people ignore is that when you get a contraction of bank credit, the shortage of credit leads to higher interest rates. And this is something, this is a problem that the Fed has. Effectively, they have lost control over interest rates. The consequences of that, I think, will really tend to make participants in markets begin to run scared, because once the Fed loses control of interest rates, we then face a situation where, with prices currently rising at around about 8-9%, probably continuing to rise, say, at 5 or 6%, you know, even if the deflationary forces do manage to sort of quieten price rises down, you're still looking at interest rates which should be above the current level by a significant margin. And that would be brought about by the contraction of bank credit. So, in effect, the Fed has a choice to make. Does it suppress interest rates again, flood markets with new quantitative easing in order to save markets, in order to keep the cost of government borrowing down, in order to hope that by stabilizing markets, that the economy itself, the underlying economy, Main Street, will stabilize and draw on that confidence from financial markets. Under those circumstances, then, you know, this sort of expansionary move and lower interest rates is fully justified. But the problem is that if they do that, they trash the currency. And that is the choice that they're going to have to make. My betting is that they have no mandate for protecting the currency. Well, not no mandate, but they have a far stronger mandate for ensuring that the government deficit is, if you like, contained as much as possible from by supporting the economy. And at the same time, that, you know, unemployment doesn't rise very substantially. And all those factors, in other words, they will opt to support the economy rather than support the currency. And it's not just the Fed that faces this problem. It is all the major central banks. We're talking about the Bank of Japan. We're talking about the ECB, Bank of England, and obviously the Fed as well. So that, I think, in a nutshell, is where we are. And I would say that it's important to understand that the purchasing power of the dollar, which is no longer anchored to legal money, which is gold, and you know that's something we can explore.
Because
it's no longer anchored to it. You know, you can find that the purchasing power of the dollar, if confidence goes in it, basically will collapse.
Yeah, it's a con game, isn't it? Are you seeing evidence of banks withdrawing credit now to a great extent? Because I heard somebody, not one that looks at these statistics normally. So somebody was, I can't remember who was claiming that no reason to get worried about a recession now because credit, at least in the United States, is very strong. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, one thing that I think we should bear in mind is that the U.S. commercial banking system is not nearly as highly leveraged as the Japanese system and as the Eurozone banking systems. They are extremely highly leveraged with asset to equity, balance sheet equity ratios in excess of 20 times. Now, that is extraordinarily high. In America, you have got, I think virtually all the major banks are over 10 times, but we're not talking about that sort of that real extreme. So I think the way to look at it is that in America, it's less so than elsewhere. But even then, put yourself in the shoes of a banker. Where are all your loans? Well, perhaps the majority of your loans are into the financial sector. In other words, you're supporting hedge funds, hedge fund borrowing, for example. You're supporting speculative borrowing. You're supporting positions in the derivative markets.
Yeah.
Now, what you're now seeing is you're seeing the value of your collateral go down. I mean, if someone has lodged the long bond with you as collateral since March 2020, it is actually halved in price.
Yeah.
So, you know, that gives you an example of the sort of pressure that a banker feels on the loan side. And he can see that with rising interest rates, even as they've risen above where they went in 2019 and 2018-19, they're above that level now, there will be many, many of his customers, both in the financial sector and also in the non-financials, who will be running into difficulties, loan difficulties. So he can see that his level of non-performing loans are set to rapidly increase unless he can get that situation under control as a matter of urgency. Yeah. So this idea that we're not going to see a contraction of bank credit in the US economy, I think is extremely false. You've only got to look at the level of margin debt, which is published by NASDAQ, and to see how that has actually fallen off a cliff. That is bank credit. That is supported by bank credit. Mm-hmm. So that is contracted.
Yeah.
You've only got to look at at the broad money supply statistics. They're no longer expanding. In fact, they topped out. If you look at M3, that topped out in, I think it was May this year, and has been continuing to drift lower. And that doesn't necessarily reflect the whole position. Look at the loan officer surveys. They're all turning pretty bearish. So you can see that, yes, the conditions are in place for a substantial contraction of bank credit.
Yeah, and you didn't mention mortgages in the United States. It's a big deal. They're twice as a 3.5% is a 7% mortgage now. And it's just absolutely killing the housing market. So that's such a major part of our economy. You have to think there's going to be some economic weakness that comes along as well, which will start to create, you know, cause other loans to be in trouble in the books of those banks. One thing I want to ask you, Alistair, you know, you've talked in the past about a lot of the central banks themselves are having trouble now. I'm going to say they're having trouble yet, but they're at least on their balance sheets are not looking all that great because they own a lot of securities that they bought, you know, bonds they bought when interest rates were 0% or 1% or 2% or whatever. And now those rates have skyrocketed. So those bonds are underwater. So the central banks themselves, in many cases, and which leads me to a thought that Jim Rickards has expressed in the past, that he thought the next, after the 2008, the next time around, the central banks themselves may not be in great shape to bail people out, to bail companies out, to bail governments out. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's absolutely right. This is now becoming more of a public issue since you and I first started talking about this. And we've seen the Dutch central bank, for example, claim that they don't have a problem because they just revalue their gold. I'm sorry, I know they've got a lot of gold, but it's not going to be enough to bail out the losses from the bonds on their balance sheets acquired as part of the ECB's quantitative easing or special asset purchase programs or whatever they call it. The Fed is deeply underwater. And they're riding it out, saying, well, you know, we're going to hold these things to maturity. So mark to market doesn't really matter. Mm-hmm. The Bank of Japan is in the most terrible mess. I mean, they've been doing QE since the year 2000.
Yeah.
And that long-term trend of interest rates, declining interest rates, has now reversed. They're getting deeper and deeper into problems. So really what we have is one of the functions of a central bank is basically to rescue failing commercial banks. So we're now in a situation where we see insolvent central banks being tasked with rescuing insolvent commercial banks. This is not going to end well.
Mm-hmm. And we have this inflationary problem, at least in part. It's not just the monetary aspect, but it's also some supply chain issues that have come into place in no small part because of geopolitics and sort of green energy initiatives that the West at least has started implementing. And I have to ask you about this ongoing war in the Ukraine. I know you felt that it would be certainly not in the best interest of the West to put sanctions on Russia. How do you see that playing out now? Your idea was that probably what Putin really wants to do is get the United States out of Europe, I suppose, so that he can have those markets to sell his gas and to trade with Europe. Is that what you're thinking?
I think, yes, it's partly that. I think there is this other Russian sense of insecurity mm-hmm. when its borders are surrounded by its enemies. Mm-hmm. I mean, fortunately, I think since we last spoke, there have been moves to try and get the Ukrainians to talk with the Russians. There's obviously been a lot of back-channel activity between America and Russia. I think it comes with a realization from the American side that this is proving to be disastrous, not just for Ukraine, but for the whole of the NATO alliance and mm-hmm. also the whole of the world. So they're trying to step back on this. And I note that there are parallel discussions been going on between President Xi and Biden, which look to me like, overtures towards peace. So on that basis, we have seen a major change. Now, I suspect that the retreat from Kherson is to do with creating a position whereby the Ukrainians can actually talk with credibility to the uh-huh. Russians. Uh-huh. I feel that that is why that's happened. Now, having said that, I don't think we've got a quick fix. We can probably have a ceasefire in the Ukraine. But when it comes to the situation with NATO. First of all, I think that the Russians are not going to want Ukraine in NATO. And secondly, they're going to want the withdrawal of threatening weapons mm-hmm. in surrounding nations on her western boundary. So this is not going to go away easily.
No, I understand that within the administration here, there's some conflicting views on what should be done. And I might say that if we withdraw weapons from the Ukraine, that doesn't help the bottom line of the military-industrial complex companies. So I think there's a lot of desire to keep some kind of war going all the time, unfortunately. And Americans don't see why Russia should feel threatened. Why, goodness, they should just let us take them over. Then they would be better off, right? So,
anyway. Well, I'm sorry, but when it comes to sovereignty, that is always a no-no. I mean, look at it the other way around.
Well, national sovereignty, are we really interested in it? Where the World Economic Forum wants to get rid of boundaries. We don't have one on our southern boundary anymore. People can come in, millions of people. We don't know who they are coming into the United States. We need labor, that's for sure. So that's good, I suppose, to a certain extent. But I don't know. Does anybody really respect sovereignty anymore? I don't know. Doesn't seem. Well, I talk to my friends, and I tell my friends I'd like to see Germany remain Germany and Britain, and Denmark, and everything else. But they don't seem to get it. So I don't know.
I think sovereignty is actually very, very important in people's minds. I mean, it's not something that they consider every moment, but if you threaten to take it away, I think they very definitely have an opinion. So,
yeah,
so, I,
We have a divided world too, in terms of this issue of Russia. And I just noticed this morning that the G20, they're having a lot of trouble getting everybody on board. That is the United States and Britain, to get everybody on board to condemn Russia for their actions.
I'm afraid that we're a minority. We look at NATO and friends. We are around about a bit over a billion people. Asia and all the rest of it, SCO and so on, you're talking about 4 billion. So we are in a tiny minority, and we're not going to get the support of, if you like, so-called independent nations like Indonesia.
With just a minute left, and maybe take a few seconds to tell us why you think gold hasn't performed better. It's done better in the last week or so. But it's sort of been a little disappointing, even though, as I pointed out in my monologue, that gold is only down 2.3 or 2.4% this year compared to 30% for treasuries, so it hasn't been bad. But are we going to see some sort of a rally in the precious metals now?
I think so, because with this pivot, I mean, it's clear that the word's going out that the Fed is going to pivot. And I think that means that gold will go higher in dollar terms because the dollar will go easier. But also, if you look at other currencies like gold priced in sterling and euros and yen, it's actually doing what it should do, is protecting citizens from the debasement, the debauching of their fiat currencies. So it's doing the right thing. And remember, it is legal money.
Yeah, we have to talk about that another time. Why is gold legally money? It's been deemed illegal money here in the United States. So we'll talk about that another time. Thank you so much, Alistair, for being with us once again, for sharing your insights with our listeners. It's always appreciated.
My pleasure, Jay.
All right, folks. Well, that's it for this week. Next week, John Rubino joins me, as does Michael Oliver and Michael Spreadborough of Noble Resources. Until then, goodbye and God's blessings to you.
Thank you again for listening to Turning Hard Times into Good Times with Jay Taylor. Please join us again next Tuesday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.